I'm Mark Olson, and this is The Real, a podcast where culture and entertainment meet. I write about movies here at The Times, and a frequent topic of conversation among my colleagues on the entertainment staff is how tough it is for any of us to just keep up with a relentless wave of content between movies and TV. So this show is about the stuff that we're watching and how we watch it.
This entire country is getting more disgusting by the second.
That's a demo we're targeting mostly on Facebook.
Game of Thrones, Jane the Virgin, Veep, The Big Bang Theory, Broad City, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. These are only some of the shows signing off this year. The end of so many beloved and long-running series will leave a hole in our hearts and disrupt our viewing patterns, and leave us searching for new and different television companions to fill their place. Why the rush to the exit? And why is it so hard for creators to stick the landing when they wrap their shows? On this episode, we're not ashamed to say that there's a grieving process in saying goodbye to our trusted friends on TV, and our critics are working through the pain with you. Let's listen in.
They're coming. Our enemy doesn't tire. Doesn't stop. Doesn't feel.
We're going to start with the biggest of them all, Game of Thrones. We recently saw the final episode, and the series has really been one of the most talked about, most watched pieces of television, or really any mass media, of recent memory. And so for something of a Game of Thrones exit interview, I'm joined today by...
Mary McNamara.
And calling in from New York...
Meredith Blake.
And so I feel like we have a small council here today. And so, Mary, I know you really have been very invested in the show right from the very start. And so I want to begin with you. How do you feel about the finale? Like, big picture, what are your kind of impressions of how it went?
Oh, my goodness. I do feel sort of like when they asked Mao what we think of the French Revolution, and he's like, I don't know yet. I started my career as a television critic. My first big review was the end of The Sopranos. And I think that that's something that we should bear in mind, because people came out of the finale of The Sopranos spluttering and outraged. And then the dust settled and a lot of people renegotiated how they actually felt about the final scene. So I think we're going to see some of that going on. The Bran thing, I don't know what to tell you, but it seems like Tyrion is actually ruling Westeros. And I'm okay with that. I think that that makes sense to me. The way they got there was not as smoothly handled as some of the other big moments in Game of Thrones, because they decided to structure it the way they did with six episodes that varied in length, but most of which were over an hour. I don't feel like the writers were comfortable with that format. I think that showed. I thought that the pacing was odd.
And Meredith, for you, what's your big picture takeaway from the finale?
I largely agree with Mary in that on paper, the Bran ending makes a certain kind of sense. I just don't think the way it got there was handled very well. It was uneven at best. I think it was pretty haphazard last season. And I think it felt like they had an end point in mind and they just kind of rushed to get us there. There were times where it felt bloated and there were times where it felt rushed. You know, it was this kind of weird combination of these huge sweeping spectacles and then moving on to the next thing. And I think that we saw that especially in the last episode. You had this huge climactic moment where Jon kills Daenerys, and then a couple weeks later or a couple months later, it's unclear how much time has passed, and Tyrion wakes up in jail. He goes before the Small Council, and then in like a matter of 30 seconds convinces them who should take over the Iron Throne. And everyone's like, cool, that sounds good. And this war that's been raging for a decade or however long it is in the world of the show is over. But with which it was resolved just made no sense in the world of the show. And it does make me wonder how they came to this timeline.
There was all this speculation about who's going to win the Iron Throne and who will rule. How did you feel, Mary, about the fact that they solved that question with Bran in this unexpected way, but then also destroyed the Iron Throne, the thing everyone had been after?
Well, I never thought the Iron Throne was going to survive the finale, because it was a symbol of war and death and all of the things that the heroes, including Daenerys, were throughout the season trying to end. That we need to work together, which was what the whole Night King MacGuffin, as it turned out. And so I didn't think that the throne was going to make it. And I knew that the dragon was going to melt it, because they kept referencing the fact that it had been built by Dragonfire. And hey, we have a dragon now. So that seems like sort of obvious. But to Meredith's point about naming Bran as king was very odd. I would have liked to have seen the look on Peter Dinklage's face when he got the final pages. Oh, so I have to sell the entire finale. Is that what you're telling me? Tyrion basically talked us through what their thinking was.
And how did you feel about that, Meredith?
And I think the Iron Throne was the metaphor, as Mary said, of oppression and war and violence, and to invoke the late departed Daenerys Targaryen, it's the wheel, right? So I think melting it is fine. Obviously, the monarchy is going to continue in some capacity. I did find the whole dragon melting thing a little corny. I just was wondering, is Drogon a pacifist? Like, what is the message he's sending here? I was kind of struggling with that a little bit.
We hadn't really been aware that he was involved in politics at this point.
Mary, you wrote a piece this week about how Tyrion carried the season from beginning to end. Will you talk about that a little?
Well, if you look at the show, which I have watched all of it again prior to the finale, Tyrion does a lot of heavy lifting throughout in terms of plot, mainly because his character is untethered from the actual Game of Thrones because he's never considered at any point in contention for rulership for the throne. And also because as a Lannister, he is protected in ways that other characters are not. So he's the best traveled person in the whole show. He's been more places than anybody. He's interacted with more of the players than anybody. And at every turn, he is moving the larger plot forward in a way that, say, Arya, who is also fairly well traveled, but her plot is her personal journey. I went back to my original review. I reviewed the first season and Peter Dinklage walked away with the show then, even with Sean Bean occupying far more screen time and Sean Bean being a very fine actor. But you know, Tyrion was always a favorite character. He was funny. He was smart. He was able to say things. And Peter Dinklage was one of the finer actors. This was a big cast. It was a very young cast in many ways. A lot of the leads were unknowns. And then you had as secondary and tertiary characters, some very fine actors who then got killed off slowly, so that you were basically left with Peter Dinklage and the Stark children. You needed an actor with serious chops, and this character has always been there at the center of everything. So in that way, it made perfect sense. That's what Tyrion was basically saying, is that Daenerys did win in the end because she did have this vision, which now we're going to carry out, even though she was unable to. So in that way, I thought that was kind of a nice testament to who she was, although they could have easily had that whole ending with Daenerys in control.
Meredith, you wrote a piece this week that was about the fact that this final season, and I think the finale in particular, really did wrong by the women of Westeros. Can you talk a little bit about that? What is it that you feel the show kind of failed their female characters at the end?
Well, I think the show all along has kind of had a somewhat mixed track record when it comes to women. On the one hand, it's introduced a real wide array of fascinating, complicated characters from Daenerys to Cersei to Margaery Tyrell. It's just one after the other rich, complicated characters that you just don't see anywhere. But at the same time, it's relied on sex position. It's used women's naked bodies as kind of set dressing. It's had some icky rape storylines, and it has not responded well to criticism in those regards. I think it's worth noting it hasn't had a female director or female writer since season 4, which is half the run of the show. And that matters. In the final run, you saw some turns with some of the most beloved female characters that either weren't earned or played into really negative stereotypes about women, which maybe if they'd just been given a little more attention, those character arcs would have been justified, specifically Daenerys turning into kind of a crazy warmonger. Brienne is really one of the great characters in the show. She was knighted, which was a great moment, but an episode later, she and Jaime sleep together in this moment that read a little bit too much like fan fiction to me. And then the next morning, Jaime is off to King's Landing to reunite with Cersei, and she's weeping at his departure. And this is a character who's always been defined by her vehement independence. It just seemed wrong. And then in the finale, we see her literally writing Jaime's story into the history of Westeros, and she's crying and serving his narrative. And it just felt like she'd become an accessory to his story as opposed to her own kind of heroine of her own tale. Even Tyrion's speech about who has the best story, which Peter Dinklage sold as best as anyone probably could. But the idea that Bran's story was better than Sansa's story, better than Arya's story, or even better than Jon's story, I think is kind of laughable. Sorry, Bran.
I just didn't have the issue with Brienne and Jaime that everybody else did. One of the most powerful scenes in the whole show is way back, I can't even remember which season is, when Jaime tells Brienne what happened when he killed the Mad King. They're in like a hot tub or something. And it's a beautiful, intimate moment where he is explaining. And she says, why didn't you tell this to everybody else? Because he's saying, I did this to protect the people of King's Landing because they didn't even stop to ask. And so there was this deep connection between them that I think is why she was writing in his thing. But I do agree, that's what we got. And we didn't get anything else, like sort of really blows. Again, it comes down to the pacing and why they decided not to give themselves at least 8 episodes where I feel they could have done all this more organically.
Some of the decisions were so strange to me. Like, well, number one, the way that there were a couple of really big reveals that were off camera that we never saw, like John telling his sisters that he
was Aegon
Targaryen, for one. Or everybody finding out that John just killed Daenerys. Again, happens off camera. And we just wake up a couple months later and Tyrion's in jail and John is, I guess, in jail too. And we never find out how anyone reacts. It just seemed rushed in this very strange way that actually sucked some of the drama out of it instead of adding to it.
The response to the finale especially has been so strong, mostly towards the negative, some people liking it. Mary, you wrote a piece in the week building up to the finale. You kind of reveled in the fact that the fandom was in tumult like this. What was it that you liked about the fact that people were so upset by what they'd been getting?
I just love how invested everyone is in this show, giving us an outlet to talk about these issues about television as a whole, about society as a whole, the power of women, inclusion. I mean, you could have a whole other conversation about what happened to the non-white characters, the ship off to an island. What this show has done, and at a time, especially when nobody is going to single shows, very few single movies, these broad audience things just don't exist, to watch that happen on an HBO show, a fantasy that when it came out, many people were like, oh, women aren't going to watch this. Oh, older people aren't going to watch this. Oh, smart people aren't going to watch this. This is all just swords and sandals. To see this wide demographic come together and talk about all of these different things, whether it's the social issues or how you write a story or how you develop character, the granular nature of some of the criticism is just unbelievable. And to me, that's great. And that's what happened to television in the early 21st century, where everybody was blogging about these shows episode by episode. It's like a tabula rasa, actually, you know, watching everybody project their hopes and fears and desires and anger and onto this show. I just think it's fascinating. So to me, it becomes then less about how do you judge, is it good or bad? More about how has it stirred everybody up to talk about what is good and bad and what we expect from our entertainment at this moment in time. And nothing has done it more than Game of Thrones.
And now, Meredith, what do you think happens to all this fandom now that the show that it's centered around is over?
That's a great question. I would like to know, because I do feel like from just a strictly professional perspective, this show has been really rewarding and really fun to write about, especially in an era of such kind of fractured audiences, to have something that a lot of people are watching at the same time. And I just don't know when that'll happen again. And I never want to say never, especially with pop culture, but it does feel like the end of an era in a lot of ways for people like me, people who write about culture. I mean, I think it will find new outlets. I just don't know if everyone will settle on the same subject anytime soon.
And because, Mary, you have declared and defended Game of Thrones as the greatest show ever a number of times. And why are you invested in that idea? Is television itself a Game of Thrones, like something to be won?
That's a good point. Whether do we need to anoint one thing the greatest thing? No, we don't, because you can't compare apples and oranges. But my argument towards Game of Thrones is that nothing at this scale had been done so successfully before and on television, even in the movies. The Lord of the Rings, which I adore, it didn't have to do what Game of Thrones had to do. The level of difficulty was actually lower for Lord of the Rings than it was for Game of Thrones, because you were doing a television show, you ran out of source material. To the extent that you might be able to argue that it didn't stick its landing, it's kind of astonishing that it didn't fall apart before now. And it went out strong, and it went out strong in ways that pissed people off, for sure. There is nothing to compare it to, and that cannot be said about anything, including The Sopranos and The Wire and all the really great shows. There were things you could at least compare them to, but there's really nothing you can compare Game of Thrones to. Everybody's screaming for their Game of Thrones. Netflix wants its Game of Thrones. Amazon wants its Game of Thrones. It's never going to be something that comes out of that request. HBO, they didn't even really publicize it when it came out. It was just sort of like, oh yeah, here's this thing. We're trying something a little different. That's where it comes from. It always comes from left field, the big, huge things. It's the magic. It's magic.
And Meredith, what about all the attention the coffee cup incident received?
I think the huge clamor over that was both a testament to the show's popularity and kind of the obsessive watching, viewing of it. Fans are watching it more closely on their TV than apparently anyone in the visual effects department did or editing suite did. But it also was kind of like a visual metaphor of how people felt about the season, which is that it was a little sloppy. The same attention to detail and love and care was not there in the storytelling. I think if the season had stuck the landing, I think people wouldn't have cared so much about the coffee cup. But because they stumbled a bit, they freaked out.
I wonder, have people gone back through the rest of the episodes?
I mean, apparently there's one shot in, I think it's in Dorne or something, of Jamie holding a coffee cup. So no, it's not the first time it's happened. And, you know, anyone who's ever been on a set can tell you there's coffee cups everywhere. So it's not really that surprising. But I guess it's more surprising no one noticed it in the post-production process.
And so with that, we're going to wrap up this part of our conversation about television finales, of which there are so, so many happening right now. We're going to take a brief break and do a little change in the cast of characters for our conversation on television finales, Game of Thrones, and beyond.
Hi, everyone. It's me, Lucas Peterson, LA Times food columnist, and I think you'll be pleased to learn that the LA Times food section has relaunched both online and in print. We have excellent recipes, outstanding reviews, unbelievable local food news, all for you at the very affordable price of 99 cents for the first 4 weeks for online access and $1.99 per week after that. Find our content online every day and in print on Thursdays. Go to latimes.com/hungryla to subscribe.
My character is the complete opposite of me. I am nothing like Jane. I mean, like, I based my character off of my baby cousin, who is literally Jane. Valedictorian, teenage mother. She did not get pregnant, artificially inseminated, but that's the ridiculousness of our show. But I had to, when I read the script, I was like, I know this girl. This is my baby cousin. This is exactly like my baby cousin. So she's been the motivation throughout the years.
That was actress Gina Rodriguez in a recent visit to the Los Angeles Times ahead of the end of her show, Jane the Virgin. The coming absence of that series and the end of Game of Thrones has prompted this conversation on the fact that so many other long-running programs already have ended or will have their series finale soon. Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, Veep, Broad City, just to name a few. Meredith Blake is still with us, and joining us now are our colleagues
Yvonne Villarreal
and Lorraine Ollie.
Yvonne, we were exchanging some Slack messages the other night, just trying to think of how many shows we're wrapping up. What does that mean? Is this just sort of the natural ebb and flow of television? Is there some kind of a generational transition that's happening with all of these shows that are leaving? Why are so many significant shows leaving now?
Well, I mean, there are a number of factors. With long-running shows, you get into finances. Cast salaries have changed, producer fees have changed, just the price tag of a show becomes a little unwieldy and it just makes sense to wrap things up. Other times it's coming from the creatives of, I have this vision for how long this show could go and I want to stick to that as much as possible. Just depends.
Meredith, do you have any thoughts on like the fact that so many significant shows are leaving the air now?
And I think Yvonne's right that it's the math becomes pretty tricky after all, especially a big successful show where people are getting huge salaries and maybe one person wants to walk away and you have to make the decision, do we keep the zombie show alive and do like a facts of life situation where you like reinvent the show just to keep it going? Or do you just quit while you're ahead? I also think there's two other things, which is that there are a bunch of these female-led, mostly comedies that started 4 or 5 years ago. They're all kind of coming to an end at the same time. I also think we're in an era where this first wave of streaming shows has come and gone. The real kind of breakouts like A Catastrophe or Transparent, shows that kind of helped establish streaming networks, are saying goodbye. And now we're at this moment in media where everyone's creating a streaming network and it's fracturing even more. So it's hard to know whether there will be other shows that will kind of fill that space, if that makes any sense. They're not Game of Thrones level shows, but they're shows that found a really solid audience and fan base among critics who championed them. And it's unclear what will take the place of those shows.
Because there's so many shows, like 500 plus or whatever, especially when you include reality TV, the commitment that is required to be a TV viewer has changed. If I hadn't seen Broad City, knowing that it's only 50 episodes that I have to commit to get into it after it's wrapped its run, that's appealing versus ER, which is like 500 episodes. That's a commitment. Sometimes there's benefits to the shorter run.
And now before we get too deep into talking about all of these finales that are happening, I want to be sure to ask Lorraine about this fantastic piece you just published that was about all the unexpected parallels to our 2020 presidential race that seemed to have popped up in this finale in particular with Game of Thrones. Tell me a little bit about that. Do you think those things have been there all through the final season, or is it something specific in the finale that really drew those comparisons out for you?
I think those parallels have been there kind of all along, just in terms of like what's happening in politics, what's happening in the world. But I think they really were condensed and clear in the finale. And particularly here, we've been through this whole 8 seasons of this series. Who's going to get the throne? And, you know, it's dragons and it's battles and it's magic. And in the end, it kind of boils down to a town hall meeting. And how many of those have we seen on TV, right? And of course, and they hand it to basically the least qualified man who women have been carrying literally on their backs for the last few years, a guy who's been happy to sit back and let others do the heavy lifting. I thought we were in a fantasy here. I didn't think we were supposed to mirror exactly what's been happening, which is why when I was watching that, I thought the writers actually had fun with it when Sam brings up the definition of democracy. Why don't we do something like this? He's essentially inventing democracy. And everybody just laughs him back into his seat. So clearly the writers knew this is a parallel to this and we can have fun with it. But I do wish it had gone out with much more of a bang than an exhale, because really we were committed to Game of Thrones of storytelling, but the fantasy part of it was great. Speaking to things that are going on in our lives, but in a totally different realm, wonderful. Now don't bring it down to a town hall.
One of the challenges, I think, with a show like Game of Thrones in particular, they have so many characters, so many storylines. It's what people always said about Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. The movie had like 8 endings because they had to kind of like wrap it up and wrap it up and wrap it up. And it's the same thing here. The show seemed to have any number of endings because they had to keep kind of like wrapping up different characters.
It did. And there was a really easy solution to that. Kill half of them off. And they were fine doing that for most of the run of Game of Thrones. I don't know why at the end, all of a sudden it's like, ooh, well, gosh, maybe we just like want to put the sword down. It's like, what? No. People are supposed to be flamed and killed, and you're supposed to kill off people we love. That's what we come to you for.
You can't do it in real life.
And it could have tied up a lot of loose ends. Nobody would have had to get on that ship and go on the journey like Arya or Jon Snow back into the wilds. It could have easily just been one person sitting on that throne and a bunch of dead bodies around him. And I would have been fine with that.
And now, Meredith, what is it that we want from a finale? Like, why is it such a challenge for people to wrap up a show?
I think one of the amazing, fascinating, and kind of messy things about TV is that you're literally making it up as you go along in most cases, unless you have a finite kind of closed-ended series, like a limited series. So oftentimes the writers will paint themselves into a corner. A cast member will leave. I think the messiness of it is what makes it intriguing. And it's also what makes it hard to stick the landing, as the metaphor we've been using today. And I think on a show, especially where people are passionate it's a great reward, but it's also a great kind of burden. I think Game of Thrones, it's interesting contrasting it with something like Veep. They're two very different shows, but they're two shows that people constantly refer to as using to talk about politics, because Veep is explicitly about politics, but Game of Thrones is about power and political power. And I think the way that Veep ended was kind of pitch perfect. Again, it didn't have the same pressure as Game of Thrones, but we saw her literally sell out Gary, the only person who loves her, in order to get to claim the throne, if you want to extend the metaphor. And it really fit with what that show had to say about politics. And I think that's an example of an ending that really worked.
Lorraine, you recently said to me that your favorite series finale was the ending of Six Feet Under.
As Six Feet Under went along, like a lot of series, towards the end, it wasn't as good as it was. But the finale was so amazing because I think it tied a bunch of things together. The whole theme of the series, death, losing people, it tied that in with really specific traits of each character. And you're watching how they all die, essentially. And it's rolling forward in the future and you're seeing each one of them die. And it was emotional as well, but it was also wrapped up in the idea of, okay, well, this is like where it all ends anyway. And so it's a finale and it is the finale. Like, it is the ending. And it was just beautifully done. What marks a good finale is, does it stick in my head 2 years later, 3 years later, 5 years later, 10 years later? And I was thinking about this with The Sopranos. Yeah, I remember the finale, of course, but I don't really remember what it meant to me. And I was thinking about Breaking Bad, and I remember little pieces of it, but not as clearly as I remembered The Sopranos. And then when I think about something like The Wire and Deadwood, which didn't even have one, you know, I'm like, I don't even remember what happened. So I think that's the mark of a good finale. Did it really stand out in a way that the show did to you as it was going along? Did it really say something at the end that put this spike in it? Like, okay, it ended here and I remember this and this was a moment.
I know, Yvonne, I know the show that has meant a lot to you is ending as well, Jane the Virgin. What is it like when you're not done with a show yet? You emotionally, like, aren't ready to lose that show.
Well, the good thing about knowing that a show is coming to an end is you can sort of prepare yourself. So you can start the grieving process a little bit, like, get ahead of it. So it's a little bit different versus, like, One Day at a Time, where it was kind of like, whoa. Although that ending was satisfying to me, if it does serve as a series finale, if the show doesn't get picked up somewhere else, the way they closed it, I felt that could have been its own ending. Watching Jane, I do have some issues. I'm very team Michael, and it's not heading that way, and it's hard for me, but I'm also not so angry that I'm not going to watch the rest of it. It is nice to just see a show that has been a part of your life wrap up and have its conclusion.
Because Meredith, is the simple idea of having a television show have a finale, it still feels kind of new somehow. Obviously, going back to something like the end of MASH, there have been lots of shows that got a proper finale. But I think of TV shows as just getting canceled, abruptly leaving the air and not being wrapped up in that kind of a way. And is that part of this new culture of television that we have? Like, the storytelling is different, fans' relationship to it is different. And so there has been an increased emphasis and importance on a finale when a show does in fact end.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. While you guys were talking about shows suddenly ending, the thing that came to my mind was Twin Peaks, which left like a psychological wound on people for like 25 years. You know, that show ended the second season with Cooper, who was this beautiful angel of a human being possessed by the evil spirit of Bob. And, you know, that was deeply traumatizing. And I think there is a need and a desire for closure in stories. And I think that's one of the reasons why Sopranos continues to frustrate and anger people, because they didn't get that closure. And that's one of the reasons why people were so excited for Twin Peaks to come back, even if it came back in a very different form and didn't exactly answer a lot of questions. Look at the sitcoms of the 80s, and they just kept them going and going and going, well past the point that anyone was really demanding it. Facts of Life had like 8 makeovers. You guys, we're not talking about this enough. Or like, there was the Hogan family, and then it was Valerie's family. And I think there was this willingness back then to just keep a zombie show going that you wouldn't necessarily find now. I think now the business has changed a little bit so that you can find a home for a show that wouldn't necessarily work on a broadcast network. Maybe it'll work on a streaming and make financial sense so that you can keep it going and bring it to a good ending.
Well, I think part of that is because pre-peak TV and pre all these platforms, a show could be a hit for a long period of time because there wasn't a lot of competition. So it made sense to keep something on the air versus now. There's such a glut of TV pulling for people's attention. There are the ones that are just undeniable hits. And then there's some of the middling ones. And you have to think, does it make economic sense to sort of keep this going? But I think it's interesting what you said about Twin Peaks. Yes, we have all these series finales and it feels like there's more than ever before. But it does raise the question, like, does the series ever end now? Because there is the possibility of a reboot or a revival.
Well, Lorraine, I know you just did some interviews around Deadwood the movie. That's a show that was just abruptly canceled, didn't really get to wrap itself up in like a fan satisfying way. And as you were doing some interviews for that, did people talk at all about what it meant to them to be able to come back to this show and to sort of like continue the story?
I spoke to Ian McShane. And the idea was we weren't finished because I was saying, does this feel like it gives you closure? And he's like, no, it's more like we weren't finished with what we were doing before. Just like all the musicians that are like, we're never going to tour again. Yeah. Mm-mm. The return. Oh, the reunion. Yeah, no. They're going to show up at Coachella. 10 years later, there's Guns N' Roses. So the point is like these shows aren't done. You're not quite breaking up yet. You guys might still like
there's
be
the
happening.
Downton Abbey movie coming out.
See? Yes. Exactly. All in the Families. Come on. Everything. Yeah, no, it's not done.
Also, I think the corollary to that is also that if you don't like a reboot or the movie version that they tacked on at the end, you can just pretend
it didn't happen.
That it doesn't exist.
Yes.
You can have the original. It's like if we're going to use the Guns N' Roses analogy, it's like Buckethead. You know, you can just pretend that era of the band didn't exist, that it's just Slash and Axl, you know? So like you can pretend the Murphy Brown reboot didn't happen and you can just have the happy warm memory of the original. That's the other kind of interesting flip side of it.
So when the series Arya's Voyage comes out, I can just go, no, this is the Buckethead, and I am totally ignoring it.
But now, Meredith, maybe another sort of like interesting corollary to this, I think, is what's just happened with the second season of Fleabag, mm-hmm. written by and starring Phoebe Waller-Bridge. She has declared that she doesn't want to do this anymore. And so it's interesting how it doesn't feel so much like a big finale, but it also now feels like it's, at least for now, a finite story.
It's a big finale in my heart.
Is there something different about that?
It's a different model in that it's the British model, which is very kind of sparing. You know, it's only 6 episodes. They're about 25 minutes each. The first season was based on a one-woman stage play that she did. The second season was always going to be outside of that. I think a second season was always going to be a big lift. Let's put it that way. So I think extending it beyond that, while I would love it, I think the where it reaches in the second season is this kind of perfection. It ends on a real strong character moment that's really powerful, but not, you know, it's not a dragon melting the Iron Throne.
New neighbor?
Evidently.
Oh, hi.
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 Yvonne, you also were on set for the taping of the last episode of The Big Bang Theory. And I'm so interested in that as a traditional 3-camera sitcom, the exact kind of show that we're talking about that has just kind of steadily been popular, gone on and on for many years, had to keep coming up with new character developments. How do we keep these balls in the air in a way? And what was it like to be there to watch the creators of that show bring that to a conclusion?
So this was my second taping of Big Bang Theory. I went to one a couple years ago and it was just like nothing I'd ever seen before, just in terms of the fandom in the audience there. And that was there again for the finale, but like times 10, people were very emotional. I cried when Friends ended. And my parents were just like, why are you crying over a show ending? But it was like my show. I was talking to Steve Holland, who is the showrunner or was the showrunner the past couple seasons. And he was saying with these type of traditional TV shows, broadcast or whatever, there's a different type of relationship that people form where they're coming in week after week, at most at a certain time, if they're not watching on delayed viewing. And they've developed a different kind of relationship than you do when you're streaming something. And he equated it to like a relationship where the first months where it feels so intense and passionate, but then the love affair is over versus The Big Bang Theory, where it's kind of like you have that moment, but then it transitions into engagement and marriage and kids, and you've had all this time with it. So to say goodbye to it feels a little more emotional. Everyone in the cast was emotional. They had to stop to do touch-ups, and Chuck Lorre came out to do the clapboard.
And that's a show, it doesn't have quite the think piece culture around it that something like Game of Thrones does. And yet it still obviously has a huge fan base, is very popular. It seems like there's like a multiple versions of television operating at once, like, for lack of a better way to put it, like hip TV and then sort of unhip TV. And I like that you covered and gave so much attention to a television show that often is maybe not covered by the press as much as some other shows.
Yeah.
Well, Meredith, is there something to the idea that there are maybe different levels of television at work, that there are shows like The Big Bang Theory, which like on the pulse as other shows, but yet they're still there? I don't know if you would call a show like that the sort of like zombie show that you were referencing before. How do you feel about the fact that there are shows like The Big Bang Theory that still have this kind of super dedicated fandom to them?
Oh, I think without a doubt, there's kind of two TVs. There's big shows like The Big Bang Theory or NCIS that get many, many millions of viewers still in this era of winnowing audiences. And then there's the shows that critics write about and that Twitter is talking about, which often have a tenth of the audience, but generate, you know, 20 times the amount of press coverage. So I think there's a kind of a disconnect in terms of the conversation around TV right now. And I think that's why sometimes as a journalist, you want to sort of take a step back and think like, what is the big giant story, that show that we're not talking about, that we should be talking about, that maybe isn't getting the Emmy nominations, but has a strong fan base and loyal, devoted fan base. And I also, that point that Yvonne was reiterating about streaming versus linear television and the effect it has on the audience, I think is a really good one, because when you have a show like Game of Thrones or a Mad Men or even sitcoms, I think when you have that weekly appointment where you're checking in with a family or whatever, you do build a really strong connection to it. And the conversation around it also has time to build in a different way. And the anticipation builds in a different way than when you're sitting down over a weekend to watch something.
And now with all of the finales that we're in the midst of, it was a way to head towards wrapping up this conversation. Are there any that all of you are looking forward to, or that you're sort of like particularly emotional about? Lorraine, I mean, I don't know, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, the recent Veep finale, Orange is the New Black. Are there any other finales that sort of like are meaningful to you?
I thought the Veep finale was really meaningful. I thought they just really nailed it in terms of that character and the way that she would end it by essentially screwing everybody over around her to get what she wants and then burying her. I thought that finale was quite amazing. And I was looking forward to it. I was looking forward to the Game of Thrones finale and yeah, I don't know what else I'm looking forward to. I'm still mourning the loss of Versailles. I mean, I'm not over that yet. So.
You'll never let that one go.
I won't. I will not.
I was not expecting that. Are you trolling me?
I'm not. I'm sad.
And Meredith, are there any of the finales, recent ones, or sort of like on the horizon that are meaningful to you?
Well, one that we haven't talked about, does last year count? I mean, the Americans finale, I thought was kind of perfect.
So good.
And, you know, to Lorraine's point that it's an ending that sticks with you. And I think they really, really nailed it. I think it was kind of note perfect and heartbreaking in a way that was unexpected. And I think that was brilliant. At the other end of the spectrum, Veep was really a really fitting finale. I think the Broad City finale was great too. And it showed kind of growth and development and forward movement without being out of character for the show or for the characters. It was kind of bittersweet and had a nice kind of continuity to it.
Yvonne?
Yeah, I agree. Broad City's final season, I thought, was amazing. Opening with that, the first episode was a series of Instagram stories, and I was just amazed by it. I'm going to be sad when Jane ends.
Michael?
Jane?
We're actually not moving today because my husband just came back from the dead.
And if you've got questions...
So good to see you. Alive.
We've got answers.
I am Rogelio de la Vega. Rogelio de la Vega. Rogelio de la Vega.
It's just a personal thing. Like, I know it's fantasy-ish, like the telenovela aspect, but the representation it offered, I think I will miss, and I hope that we get something that fills that void in the marketplace very soon.
Meredith, what you said earlier about the fact that so many of the shows that are wrapping up now are like female-centered shows. Is there a sense that they're going to be replaced in kind? Is there going to be sort of a new wave of female-centric shows coming in? Or has this been a blissful little blip in the bubble?
That's a good question. That's the worry, right? That we had this kind of golden era of female storytelling on television and that it's going to end and recede and it's going to be a bunch of boring shows about dudes. but I don't think so. I think one of the shows a lot of people were excited about this year was Russian Doll, and that's that's written and directed almost entirely by women. There's a couple other shows that I think are going to be interesting in that regard that are coming. You know, Awkwafina has a show on Comedy Central. So I think, I don't know, I'm holding out hope that there will be a new kind of generation. I also think the gates have sort of opened up in terms of that. And people know that you can't just have a writer's room filled with a bunch of guys anymore. And things are genuinely changing. So yeah, I think more opportunity will lead to more great shows, even if I will forever miss Crazy Ex-Girlfriend and Broad City and everything else.
I pled guilty just for the symbolism of it. Yeah.
Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, the final season premieres.
Please let everybody know where they can find your work online. Yvonne?
I'm on Twitter at Vera Reilly.
And I'm on Twitter at Lorraine Ollie.
And Meredith?
I'm on Twitter at Meredith Blake.
And I'm on Twitter at Indie Focus. And so for LA Times Studios and The Real, I'm Mark Olson. Thanks for listening. This week's show was produced by Kitty Cooper and edited by Mike Heflin.